Hello, listeners, and welcome to episode 53 of the Criterion Reflections podcast. I'm David Blakesley here to lead us through a conversation about Roberto Rossellini's 1971 film, Socrates. And in my partner in dialogue tonight, in the Socratic conversation honoring the great man and the tradition that he founded all those millennia ago, is none other than Josh Hordenbeck. Good evening, Josh.
Good evening, David. It's really nice to be here. But I do have a question for you. What is dialogue? How do you know that you're actually having a conversation?
Well, it's good and it's pious. Well, so, that's my feeble attempt to step into the sandals of the great philosopher himself. And we may have a few choice quotes and tidbits here and there. Yeah, but this is an unusual film. It's one that I'm very eager to get into with you. I do appreciate you taking up the challenge of this, maybe not the most stimulating, grab you by the scruff of the neck and entertain you type of a film. But it's a film with plenty to say. And even though it's set in ancient times, I was struck by how it spoke to our modern condition.
Yeah.
So, but before we get into that, Josh, I know we had to kind of accelerate our recording schedule a little bit because you have some pretty big business ahead of you. So let's talk a little bit about what you've got in the near future, your annual immersion into the Seattle International Film Festival. What are you looking forward to this year?
Oh, it's going to be, I'm really excited for it. This is going to be my second year doing it full bore, taking time off from work. So this year I'm taking vacation time. So Thursdays and Fridays, so I work a shorter week. And the festival runs for 25 days, so it's a long festival. There are 410 films that are being shown over the course of those 25 days. And a lot of them are shorts, but there are 147 features. It's really neat to see that 46% of those films are by women, and 56 are by first-time filmmakers, and 59% of those are without distribution, which is really neat because there are going to be films that that you might never get a chance to see if you aren't seeing them on the festival circuit, there are films from all over the world, and so I'm excited to dive in and watch 2 to 5 movies a day, depending on what the schedule's like. And it's gonna be a lot of fun.
Are you planning to be there like every day of the festival at least once?
Yeah, I've got at least once or twice a day. That's the goal. So even on days that I work, I'll head down to the theater that's just a few blocks away from work and go see a film or two. And it makes for an exhausting month, but a really rewarding one all the same.
Well, you did a fantastic job chronicling your impressions. Sometimes short takes, sometimes you expand it a little bit. I imagine you've got something similar in store as far as capsule reviews and maybe the occasional essay or two. So
yeah.
Any particular titles that are jumping out at you that you're kind of most excited about?
You know, I'm always really, really excited for the archival films that they play. And they're playing two by Ida Lupino. One of them is The Hitchhiker, which I know that Magic Lantern cast just did an episode on. Mm-hmm. So I'm excited for that. They've got Fritz Lang's Spies, which is one I've never seen. Mm. And to get to see that on the big screen will be really, really a treat. And I'm hoping, I'm not sure if I'll be able to make it because I have to work earlier that day, but I'm hoping to make it to a screening of the classic Phantom of the Opera with a live orchestration by the Invincible Czars, who have done some really great work on that. And then there are a lot of really, really great modern films that have made the festival circuit. And then there's one that I'm really excited by called Touch Me Not, which is a pseudo-documentary. So I'm always interested in how filmmakers are able to play with the documentary form a little bit and do something that's not just an essay or a hard-hitting social justice piece. I'm looking at how filmmakers can explore the documentary form, and Touch Me Not is one that looks like that might fit the bill. And there's one, I don't have the name on the top of my head, but the new one from Mark Cousins, who did The Eyes of Orson Welles recently. Mm-hmm. He's got one where he compares the careers of two actresses by running their films side by side simultaneously, and the sound will come up for one and then fade into the sound from the other, and little bits of trivia and history are put on screen as text. And so it just sounds like a really fascinating experiment that I'm really looking forward to.
And there's also the discoveries, the surprises that will probably yep. kind of hit you out of left field. You didn't see yeah. it coming, but we'll make that lasting impression. So I am along for the journey, and I certainly encourage listeners to check out your stuff. So we'll have a link in the show notes. So please check out Josh, support his efforts, and perhaps get a little bit of your watch list stocked up with some interesting stuff coming down the pipeline here. So yeah, excellent. Well, I wish you all the best.
Thanks.
It seems like such an endurance test among many
other things. It is. Yeah. I don't watch very many films right at the week after. So
No. I think you're entitled to get out and experience the real world a bit. But excellent. Well, and speaking of what, you know, endurance tests, maybe the documentaries of a sort, here we are looking at one of the earliest of the Rossellini history films. Roberto Rossellini, of course, one of the great patriarchs of Italian neorealism, and quite a fascinating figure in his own right. Some of his films of the 40s, 50s, even early 60s are very widely revered masterpieces of not just Italian cinema but world cinema in general. And then he went off in kind of his own little idiosyncratic direction, felt that he had done everything he can with the cinematic big screen medium, and turned his attention towards television. And that's what we have here, one of his TV movies, where he had this kind of elevated notion that he's going to educate the masses by depicting the great events and characters of history in what he considered to be straightforward, realistic, meticulously researched reenactments of some of the most pivotal moments in Western civilization. So we're going to get into Socrates, which is not a film that you're going to find anywhere on Criterion disc anyways, and I'm not even sure if there's many physical media editions anywhere in the world, but it is available on the Criterion channel in streaming format. It's been available on Filmstruck, and even going back to the old days of Hulu Plus. And so, because it does have that Criterion logo, we are talking about it here on the Criterion Reflections podcast. So, Josh, before we get into the film itself, what is your experience with the Rossellini history film?
You know, the Eclipse set, the Age of Reason ones with the Age of the Medici and Cartesius and Blaise Pascal, those all were some of the first Eclipse films that I ever saw. I remember getting Age of the Medici from the Netflix mail-in service and really starting to dive into these films that were really difficult for me at the time. I hadn't had much history with Rossellini. I'd had some experience with Italian neorealism, but didn't really know much about him. And so I spent a lot of time reading about the works because they didn't connect with me right away. And I knew that there was stuff in there that I needed to wrestle with and explore a little more. And I really, I appreciated them. And I think Blaise Pascal was maybe my favorite of the set. But I was really, really intrigued, even if I found them a little more impenetrable. I was always really curious about him using the same approach for Socrates for this even further historical story. And that was one of the reasons actually why I signed up for this episode, is I hadn't seen it, but I knew the history films themselves really intrigued me, and so I wanted to dive in and wrestle with it some more. So I watched it for the first time during my Filmstruck binge just before the service closed, and so I was really excited to get the chance to revisit it, because I do think that over the decade, really, since I first started watching those history films, I feel like my tastes and my ability to appreciate this type of cinema has evolved, and I really enjoy it. It's not for everyone, obviously, but there's a lot here that's really fascinating and really intriguing.
Yeah, I feel like they're the kind of films that, you know, they test our mettle a little bit, because they don't really cater to audience taste. They're not standard entertainment by any means, even though my experience has been, once you make the acclimation, once you kind of adjust your expectations and connect to its wavelength, they, like, as you say, they're rewarding, they're rich, they are rewatchable, because there's a lot contained. The dialogue, the depth, the mise-en-scene, yeah, the recreation of these ancient environments is very well executed, but it's dry, and it's kind of didactic. And so you're right, it's not a film that I would not even necessarily recommend it for. I don't want to say young people, because there certainly are young people who will enjoy it, but it's doing your homework. I think there's a certain aspect here that it's probably best experienced as a supplement if you are maybe assigned some of these texts, and because these are dealing with, you know, great names and, you know, epochal characters, you know, as far as Pascal, Descartes, the Medicis, Socrates, and an earlier film in this series, which unfortunately Criterion doesn't seem to have the rights to, his adaptation of the Acts of the Apostles, a scriptural text, and one that I would love to see how he chose to represent that particular literary work. So maybe I'll have to seek that out at some point. But we are dealing with Socrates, an ancient figure, obviously one of the almost legendary figures of ancient Greece, although I think the historical consensus is that he was a real person and that there was a historic kernel of truth to this. Almost undoubtedly Plato, idealized some things, but there's such a compelling story at the heart of all of this as well. I'm not going to claim to be a great student of Greek philosophy, but I've been aware of this guy since my high school days, and I did take a little bit of excursion into philosophy in my college years, and Socrates was definitely one of the more appealing characters. He was, kind of the prototypical gadfly. He was the troublemaker, the guy who just asked impertinent questions and stirred things up for the smug authorities, those who considered themselves, you know, wise and in control. You know, Socrates was just there to kind of, keep things a little bit off balance, and yet, he conducted himself with kind of a purity and a singular focus and a humility that makes him a very admirable character. And he's been, made into a bit of a secular saint in the many centuries since. What are your thoughts just about Socrates as a figure, and how did his reputation and maybe inform and prepare you for the way he was depicted here?
You know, I come to Socrates not through philosophy, but through theater, through his depictions in Aristophanes, which we get into a little bit here. I know bits about the Socratic method and have read some Plato, but it was never something that I really wanted to delve into all that deeply. But I have to say that seeing the film and seeing the depictions of his life, it made me really curious about some of his actual philosophies and some of the things that he was really advocating for at the time that really seemed to go against the grain of Athenian society.
Well, let's talk about how this film is structured. We basically got kind of a two-act, dramatic presentation here. In fact, I guess Socrates gets a little bit of a star entrance because we don't really see him right off the bat. But what's, I think, helpful to me is that he's placed in a historic context where there's a political intrigue, there are forces of empire and domination and, you know, cataclysmic social upheaval going on around him. He's not just some dude in a toga spouting eternal platitudes in the Agora and being, you know, misunderstood and jeered upon and condemned by people who just don't have a clue. He truly was a troublemaker. And I guess as we go on, I mean, some of the things that just really stood out to me was how this story seems in its own way to be just a timeless commentary on humanity.
Yeah.
And on so many of the dynamics that we live with and experience around us, even though this is a faraway place and time. So we open the story of Socrates by seeing the city of Athens under siege. A man named Lysander, he's a commander of the Spartan forces, coming up from the south and taking Athens by storm. Of course, the Greek city-states, were kind of their own little domains. Athens had a special place in those ancient societies. Even then, was known as a fountain of high culture. Obviously, the mythology, the sculpture, the philosophy, the political theories and concepts of how society should be organized. This is one of those fabled societies that kind of has the reputation of being a golden age where humanity reached a level of refinement and, if not perfection, kind of an exalted status in terms of its accomplishments. And that's part of the self-mythologizing process that has, kind of captivated the West in its own kind of self-absorption over these many centuries. But I think there is some substance to this. Athenian Greek society seems to have achieved some pretty remarkable things. If nothing else, it's established reputations that have lingered and in the popular imagination. And then when you get into the substance of it, there's some richness here. And yet it didn't happen in a vacuum. And you see Sparta, the other side of the coin, if you will, the militaristic, kind of conquest oriented social forces who are not willing to allow the Athenian ideal to just sit there unmolested. And as we get into the film, we recognize, at least by the way these characters are portrayed, that there is kind of a decadence and a rot at the heart of Athens that at least partially contributed to its imminent downfall. So what did you think of those early scenes? I think those are probably the scenes that, at least to me, presented some of the most challenging portions of the film to try to kind of track with it all, make sense of it, and just get into, what you might consider the good stuff, which is the more familiar, quotes and reenactments of the trial and ultimately the death of Socrates.
Yeah, and I do think that we have the scene of them tearing down the walls, and then we move straight into the home of a wealthy Athenian ruler. And that conversation there, while it's setting the stage and helping to orient us in time, I always find that sequence to be the most difficult of the entire film, because they're throwing around names that I just don't know. They're setting up the fact that it was Socrates's pupils who helped bring about the downfall of Athens, and they're referencing a lot of historical events that, if you don't have reference for, can leave you a little lost. And That's the portion of the film that I always find the most tedious and maybe the most difficult to engage with. But it does start to slowly get you on the wavelength of the film. And so that by the time we meet Socrates and we see his interactions with his students and with the people he passes by on the street, suddenly there's a life and there's an energy and there's a even a vibrancy to the film that I don't think you would expect coming out of this long, dry prologue, essentially.
Yeah, yeah. And getting back to these disciples, right, there's this kind of elaborate setup. And again, it goes back to Rossellini's method where he doesn't really usher you in. I mean, yeah. I found myself having to kind of hit the back button a few times.
Yes. Sort
of, okay, because I'm really determined. I really want, especially in this viewing, I like you, also watched it during the last days of Filmstruck and took it in and found myself kind of, you know, along for the ride. But of course, as I'm getting ready to podcast about it, I want to really engage and really make sure I'm not missing the good parts here. And what I found is that, yeah, you have this, you know, there is this dramatic conflict. There may be some viewers who could fault Rossellini for not maybe theatricalizing it, if that's a word, a little bit more. You know, show us Lysander, show us Alcibiades, rather than just having these characters lounging about, you know, in their around the feast table in their togas, you know, just giving us pure exposition. I mean, it's a pretty dry delivery, and the information is all there.
Yeah.
But is this a budgetary thing? I mean, I feel like, especially as you get into the later films in the Eclipse series set, that this was a very intentional choice on Rossellini's part. I mean, he knows how to make movies. He knows how to, use melodramatic elements and, you know, jazz things up a little bit. He's very specifically choosing not to do that. And it gets into a little bit of his method and his aspirations, which maybe I'll just kind of set those aside for right now, because he's really just getting us into this world and perhaps trying to give us that perspective of what it's like to be a participant in this society where, you know, things are kind of falling apart. He's not showing you necessarily the heart of the conflict itself. There are a few crowd scenes. There's a little bit of a sense of some of the unrest that the city's going through, but he never gives you those set pieces that kind of, you know, engage you with, oh my goodness, this beautiful city is about to get overthrown. In fact, when the breach in the wall is first accomplished right at the beginning of the film, what'd you think of that scene? I mean, just the revelation of the Parthenon and the statue of Athena and the almost the astonishment of these invaders who, you know, perhaps were or were not expecting. I mean, I think that some people knew what they were going to see when the wall fell down, but they were covering their eyes because they recognized they were kind of looking on holy ground and weren't really quite prepared or didn't want to risk the wrath of the gods by gazing upon something that they were not really entitled to see.
Yeah, it's a gorgeous moment. And I do think that while I'm sure there were budgetary limitations placed on him working for TV, you know, he really, really is meticulous in the reconstruction of Athenian society. And that tearing down the wall, I think when I first started watching it, I was like, is this just kind of a fake plaster set? You know, what is it? But it's achieved so well, and it really it looks as real and as authentic as I think you can make it or could make it on a 1971 Italian TV budget. And that shot as you come into the city is gorgeous, and it really does, I think, help you understand that while Sparta had invaded, there still was a sense that Athenian society could be a little protected from the the brutality of the wars that were happening at that time. And we get Critias, I think is the name. I'm going to butcher some of the pronunciations here. Mm-hmm. But we have, you know, he's considered a tyrant, but he also was a student of Socrates. And now he is ruling Athens. And yeah, I think you get a sense that in the midst of this conflict, there are tyrants and there is oppression, but there is also there's also still a lot of beauty and a lot that we see later on in the film that's worth fighting for and liberating the city as well.
Yeah, Socrates himself had proven his mettle, his dedication. He had been a soldier himself. He was not just an airy, you know, ivory tower intellectual. He was a vigorous man who was now getting up there in years. He had obviously wielded influence. He had trained up, not just the younger generation, but several generations of Greek orators, politicians, warriors, civil leaders of all different sorts. And what we see now is that even within his own tradition, his own school of disciples, some serious breaches and differences,
yes,
of approach had developed. And now here we've got, in a sense, the founder of one of the significant schools of Greek political and social discourse. His disciples are at odds, and he himself, as we kind of come to see in the latter half of the film, once the kind of the circumstantial setup had been accomplished, we get into the trial and the accusations against Socrates. But another really important piece of humanizing this character was his relationship with his wife Xanthippe and the two sons. They don't really say a whole lot, but they are there, and they remind us that Socrates himself was a real human being with his own needs, his own vulnerabilities, his own emotional connections. And I thought Xanthippe actually, even though her part tended to veer towards the histrionic, I still was very moved by her performance and by reflecting on the idea that, Socrates and the troubles that he found himself in, he was not just kind of an isolated figure. His travails, bore consequences for people beyond just himself. Oh, what are your thoughts on that whole portrayal of his domestic life?
Yeah, I feel like the very first scene, he comes back to the house with the octopus. He's been out orating for days, and his disciples are like, oh, shouldn't you pick up some food for your family? Oh, yeah, I've been out for 2 days wandering around, and I went out to go get bread, but I was so overwhelmed by everything that I saw. And, that first scene feels like, in some ways, what we'd get from maybe a Fellini film, mm-hmm, or some of the other broad Italian comedies, where you have the shrewish wife and the long-suffering husband. And that sequence especially, I find a little tiresome. But as it goes on, I think their relationship is deepened, and we see more of the love that he has for Xanthippe. We see more of her concern for him and for his family as well. And I think it grows on me, mm-hmm, especially the second time. I think that first scene is so memorable and stands in so much contrast from a lot of the oration that we get in the film, that in my mind, that was entirely indicative of the character, and this was the relationship. But getting to rewatch it just before we recorded, I was like, no, there's a depth there, and there's a real warmth and love between the two of them. And so it does make his eventual death so much more moving, especially as she stands outside his cell with her children and is encouraging them to have courage and to remember the lesson that their father's teaching them.
Yeah, and there's also that tension between the visionary, the genius, the eccentric, yes, who's living out his principles, but not doing so in a vacuum, recognizing that while he's staying true to his, you know, kind of central convictions, other people are carrying that share of the load.
Yeah.
Another scene that really stood out to me was one of his first kind of philosophical waxings, where they're sitting by the river, and the young men around him, his little pack of disciples, are asking about kind of what's going on in this society, and the tyrants are taking over, and everything's falling apart, and he's like, let them do their thing. Those who are committing evil are the ones who are suffering the worst. And boy, that, I don't know, there was just something about that that exchange that it just got me thinking about our own contemporary situation, and a situation that is, it repeats itself, it seems, over the course of the decades of my life, where the scoundrels in power just seem to be, waltzing along, enjoying the fruits of their greed and ignorance and their manipulation of the masses. And here's Socrates talking about those who, lust for power, live in fear, and in the state of perpetual anxiety. It's like, so what is our choice in response to that? Those of us who maybe don't have the direct leverage to affect that, do we live in our own state of anxiety, or do we find our way out of that by perhaps focusing our mind on other things? It doesn't mean becoming apathetic or complacent or complicit. It's just recognizing a way of staying grounded in our own realities, rather than letting the torments and the tumult of our times sweep us up in events that truly are in many ways so far out of our control.
Yeah, that sequence, he says that the tyrants and the rulers are mad, mm-hmm, that they're insane, mm-hmm, and one of his disciples says, no, they're men who are doing this. They aren't just insane. They're very reasoned. They make very deliberate choices. But Socrates says, no, when you're torturing and executing half of the population and starving the other half, that's no way to rule. That, mm-hmm, that way lies madness. That what could be more insane than that? And I think, you talk about how it's hard to not overlay some of the things that were going on in this film on our own society. And I think that because it's so philosophical and it's comprised of so many of these conversations and debates about meaning, it's one of those films that is really, really rich and rewarding when you start to think about our own society, and when we start to use his thoughts and his reflections as a way to reflect upon what's going on around us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, Socrates, I think one of the, just as a figure, as a cultural, touchstone and reference point, is he was, true to himself. He lived in chaotic times, and he suffered for it. I mean, that's kind of going towards the conclusion of the film, which, even a lot of the casual students of history probably understand, what happened to Socrates, and maybe we can start picking that apart in a minute. But he lived a life, and he showed a way of life that I think even more than even Plato and Aristotle, who were probably more accomplished as far as, intellects, and certainly they wrote, they produced, works that have stood the test of time. Socrates was not a writer. He was written about, and in some ways endures maybe more as a legendary figure. And there's the whole scholarly debate about how much of this was Socrates versus how much of this was Plato Socrates. But you know, really that all sort of, you know, melts away when you think about, you know, who do you look to as a role model or as an example of how you want to stand up in the face of persecution, unrighteousness, and just kind of, you know, raw abuse of power. And I think that does kind of get us into the second half of the film, as Socrates, you know, he's been confronted, he's been accused, and now he has to, you know, make these fundamental decisions of what he's going to do in response to, you know, this, you know, perhaps unexpected, but perhaps he saw it coming all along, and he just figured just one of these days the authorities are going to catch up to him and hold him to account. And so in one of these, you know, especially from the armchair quarterback view of history, it was one of these, you know, conflicts that was just inevitable. It was going to come to a boil at some point. And that's where both the drama and the poetry of Socrates, the end of his life, was accomplished and leaves such a deep impression on those of us who've taken the chance to look it over and think about it.
Yeah, and I think we get the hints of it so early on in the film as he is being chastised for corrupting the youth of Athens. Mm-hmm. And his response is always, I'm not actually teaching them anything. I'm just asking them questions. Right. I'm asking them to refine their thoughts. I'm asking them to seek for truth. And you get the sense that, you know, really no matter what society we're in, I think we're often afraid of the truth. We're afraid of having illusions or having our presuppositions or having our prejudices, having those things shattered. And you see it in a couple of really key conversations that I find absolutely delightful, when someone is talking of beauty and he asks, what is beauty? And he completely dismantles their definition of beauty. Mm-hmm. Or when someone asks about piety and what is piety, and he says, well, it's doing what the gods want. Well, the gods fight amongst each other. So if you're doing something that pleases one god, doesn't it displease another god? So then you're doing something that's both pious and impious. So you haven't helped me understand what piety is. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And he does it in this really, really disarming way.
Well, what he's doing is kind of holding the platitudes of the power structure itself up for examination and basically exposing the weakness, whether it's a pure ignorance because you just haven't thought it through, or more likely an intentional oversight or suppression of the truth, or of the, you know, kind of the ambivalence at the heart of so many of these deeper questions of life. The trouble for Socrates is that he's teaching young people how to think, rather than just following orders or just blandly accepting the platitudes and the cliches and the formulas that support the status quo and ultimately benefit those in power and positions of privilege from being questioned or overtly challenged. You know, Socrates is never willing to just allow the conventional wisdom to prevail without at least, you know, casting a little side-eye glance and asking an impertinent question or two. And it's just one of those kind of slow and steady wins the race in terms of that continual nicking away, that chipping away at the foundations of the assumptions that so many people have.
Yeah.
And again, that's just such an indelible aspect of just how human societies are structured. And, you know, I'm not a guy who's out there, you know, throwing Molotov cocktails and tipping cars over myself. and I participate in the status quo to a certain extent, but to what degree do we want to avoid being completely co-opted or becoming subservient to the forces of injustice and exploitation? And that's the line where Socrates, you know, he's not fomenting revolution. He's not even openly challenging or enticing the young or the old to open impiety or scorn of authority. He's just, again, asking those questions and drawing younger people to himself to say, let me show you my method. And also being true to that inner voice. That's another kind of interesting aspect.
Yeah.
He talks about, you know, he doesn't really know anything, but he does listen to this inner voice and he follows that lead, and he encourages others to find their inner voice, their God, if you will, and to allow that leading impulse to guide their steps rather than the voices of the louder and more powerful external authorities that would rather issue orders and just have that blind obedience. And I think that is again just one part of the enduring heroism and charm of Socrates as a figure.
Yeah, and you know, I really love the sequence when he is asked why he doesn't go into politics. Mm-hmm. Why don't you go there and make a difference there? And he says, no, I felt like I could do that and influence maybe a couple of people, but really it's about being here among the people, among the ordinary people where I can make the most difference. And that's why he doesn't take money for his teachings, partly because he says he doesn't know anything and it would be foolish to take money for telling people that he doesn't know anything. it's a delightful approach to the idea that you can make the greatest social change by not by gaining power, but through conversations, through the exchange of ideas, and through challenging each other, and through challenging ideas, mm-hmm. and not just letting, you know, he never lets an idea that he disagrees with pass him by. He never lets anyone just get away with uttering platitudes. It is all fair game for him to challenge in discourse. And I find that really, really fascinating, really beautiful, and really challenging as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and he's never getting loud. He's never mocking. He's never using... And you know, he's got this intellect. I'm sure he's got you know, all the zingers and all the repartee and all the comebacks and put downs if he wanted to exercise, but that's just not in his character. And yet he does ultimately fall victim based on the principles that he adheres to and the, you know, the forces of corruption and censorship ultimately that kind of, you know, cost him his life. So you know, and again, the film kind of neatly divides into two parts. Right around the 1 hour mark is when Socrates faces his accusations, and now he's got a whole series of difficult decisions to make, especially with those closest to him, you know, continually offering him this, you know, one or the other easy way out.
Yeah.
That if you just, you know, kind of, you know, accept the exile or agree to, you know, quiet yourself down or to not speak to anybody under 30, you know, he's continuing to put up all these challenges. You know, so again, kind of lead us into some of that, aspect of the film, and you know, particular moments that stood out to you as we kind of get into the trial and death of Socrates.
Yeah, you know, I find it interesting to think about the choices that he has to make, because he is accused of impiety and of corrupting the youth. And he's offered the choice to hire an orator to defend him. And we get to see what that is. And for a film that has such a reputation of being dry and boring, there's some real humor throughout, like in his rhetorical conversations. And I do think the sequence in which the orator is laying out exactly what he's going to do and how he's going to save Socrates' life. I find that scene really, really fun and really delightful, because we see the emptiness of so much of this rhetoric and so much of the defense that was going to be mounted for Socrates. And it's a really lovely bit where he then says, you know, how is this speech going to do my accusers or the judges any good? How is this going to help them? Yeah. I want to lift up society in everything that I'm doing, and this isn't going to do that.
Yeah. And the orator said, well, I'm here to help you. I'm your agent. I don't care about the judges, you know. And again, what a illuminating mirror it's holding up to our own society. I mean, we see time and time again where it's not so much the substance of what was actually done, but it's like, how can I wriggle off the hook? How can I create just enough of that little room for doubt, or at least you can't pin that final convicting piece of evidence on me, and I get away with it. I don't have to suffer the criminal penalties because there was just that big enough loophole that I could squeeze through. And thank you to my team of lawyers who purchased my freedom with a web of sophistry and occasionally deceit. And that's exactly what was happening here. The orator was going to basically play the game and give him his ticket out. And, you know, the implicit understanding is like, you better not do this again. We'll let you off the hook. You'll concede to our authority, and we will let you live. And again, Socrates and his dogged pursuit of truth on his own terms. No, that's too much of a compromise, because I need to edify those who want to persecute me. And again, it's a very kind of a sacred example that he's giving. I mean, Socrates is one of those pre-Christ figures, I guess, from the Christian era, where his virtue and his humility, you know, kind of make him an iconic figure and a precursor to a different way of living and being in this world that didn't concede to the more overt and grotesque examples of how power could be wielded to brutal advantages.
Yeah, and in some of the reading that I've done in between viewings, just the exploration of the idea that Socrates, there are some scholars who think that Socrates sacrificed himself for the good of Athens, that it was really an act of selfless giving, that allowed him to go to his death willingly. And I think you're right. I think there is that kind of almost messianic quality to him here.
And his death wasn't without purpose, but it was a way of sort of breaking this tension. You had the invaders who, you know, for their own reasons decided not to completely loot and trample the city, but they wanted in and they wanted to run the show. Then you had the old order of Athens that recognized that, you know, they'd been thwarted, but if they could still retain at least some of their privilege and comforts, they'd willingly go along with this new order. But, you know, with Socrates and with his tradition and his following, the question was, how was Socrates going to tip the balance here? Would he go along with this new order of things, or would he, you know, stir up trouble and you know, perpetuate the conflict. I think that's another, maybe even a more of a historic angle, is that Socrates recognized that his very presence and his role as a known kind of iconoclast and disruptor or questioner of the status quo, you know, created this uncertainty, this tension. Just again, going back to the, you know, the example of Jesus and his following this kind of third way between the priestly order of the old, you know, Israelite, the Jewish contingent and the Roman occupation in Palestine. Well, where do Jesus and his followers fit into all of that, festering, cauldron of tensions? While he was not a militant revolutionary, nor was he one just to concede and surrender to the imperious Romans and what they were laying down. So there are some really fascinating parallels and the power of a nonviolent resistance that really, the principalities and powers don't really know what to do with it. And even though it may feel passive and meek and kind of ineffectual in the short run, well, history tells us that these cultural forces have long legs, and they make dramatic and sweeping impacts over the course of eons.
And we remember the name of Socrates, and we don't remember the name of the ruler.
Alcibiades or Critias or whatever. Yeah, right. They're side characters, and they had their moment in the sun, but that came and went as well.
Yeah, I like the parallels you're drawing between kind of Jesus and the disciples and Socrates and his disciples, because there were moments throughout the film that it felt very much like what you'd get from that era's depictions of the Christ story, and just the wandering through the streets and the meeting people and the engagement and conversation that just seems to be a structure of those types of ancient passion narratives. And I found that really, really interesting this time through.
And I think Rossellini is trying to give us that kind of depiction of these grand traditions, these rhetorical exercises, these encounters between men of a very deep and powerful intellect, but also a very compassionate heart, kind of a soul that relates to the common person. So there is an inspirational quality to this, although the story of Socrates probably doesn't have nearly the same kind of religious pathos element, and that's again why I'm so curious to see his depiction of the Acts of the Apostles, especially as we kind of go down this venture down this lane of discussion to think about another depiction of the ancient world, and you see elements of that in some of those later Renaissance era films and Enlightenment films that we've already referred to earlier in this conversation. But let's go ahead and kind of pursue this towards the end. When you get to the final trial of Socrates, he makes his statement. And again, it's just another really marvelous moment. If you've read Plato's account, some of this is lifted pretty straight from the page. And again, I respect Rossellini's straightforwardness in bringing those texts to life. I think if you really are engaged in any kind of serious study of Greek philosophy, this is a really excellent enhancement of that research, because it just really puts those words into a human context that I think, obviously is probably going to be idealized to a certain degree, but it's just got the look and the feel and the tactile sense of what this might have been like. Certainly as close as I'm sure probably any other film has even begun. I don't know how many cinematic adaptations there have been of this era of ancient Greece. This has to be the best presentation of that scene or of this whole sequence of events that's ever been produced. I feel pretty confident in saying that without really having a lot of research at my disposal.
Yeah. Yeah. And I will say that the performance by, I'm going to butcher the name, but Jean Silvère, who plays mm-hmm. Socrates, is really magnificent. And again, these films have such a reputation for dryness, mm-hmm. but there is such warmth and compassion mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. in all of his rhetoric and all of his speeches. And this final speech, his defense of himself, is really beautiful. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think that it definitely is a designed to gain our sympathy and to help us empathize with Socrates as he's on trial. But it's a really passionate, really beautiful, well-reasoned dismantling of the prosecution's case against him, which to me makes his death all the more tragic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's very clear-eyed. He understands completely the consequences of his words. You know, he's not delivering a speech that the jury is going to embrace and go for, but he's again remaining true to his convictions, his core principles, and without apology, without any kind of scheming or manipulation, he's speaking from the heart and in a way delivering a word of judgment on his accusers.
Yeah.
Because he understands the inherent truth, and yet how unacceptable that is when compared to the kind of expediency with which his accusers are saying, here's the case of why we need to get rid of this guy. And, yeah. and that's the thing. He is more trouble than he's worth, basically, is kind of a blunt way of putting it. And nothing Socrates says really is there to convince them that, hey, I'm not such a big deal after all, or give me a break. We can coexist. He's like, I'm going to be who I am. I'm going to stand yeah. for what I stand for.
Yeah.
And your worst consequence is not enough to dissuade me. And yet, it's still very devastating when that final verdict comes down. And again, chance after chance, they're giving them the exits. They're saying, here's your exile, here's this, here's that. It's like, no, this is what I need to do. And so while there may be a bit of that, self-abnegation, some might even say it's suicidal, pursuing a martyr's fate. But it's so based on kind of a realistic set of beliefs about what his life has always been about, that's what makes it persuasive and admirable for me. Even though, again, you wince at the fact that that's kind of how this world operates. The pure souls just really are not made for this plane of existence, and that's just the heart-wrenching agony of it all.
Yeah, and I love the sequence. You know, he's been pronounced guilty, and he is offered a chance to mitigate his sentence. He's told, give us another option, and he's like, look. What are you going to do? Exile me? If you exile me, I'm going to be just as troublesome to those people as I am to you. So that's stupid. You can't give me a fine because that would be like taking my life from me because I don't have any money. So, here, I've got an idea. Why don't you put me in the government and feed me and pay me and we'll call it good.
Yeah.
And I love that sequence, but the death sentence is really sad, and we see how much it affects his disciples and his family the weight. And again, he's given another chance because his disciples have arranged for a way for him to escape.
Yeah.
But he refuses to take it.
Yeah, he cannot use, you know, devious means at this point. I mean, he's laid himself out there. He's made his standards known, and to weasel out of it would just be to, you know, undercut in all aspects the hypocrisy, you know, that he really, that is his ultimate thing he wants to avoid. I mean, he would lose it all if he were found to just be an opportunist in the face of everything that he said. So yeah, there is this these words of benediction, his last moments with a wife and children, and the gathering around of the disciples, and then his end. And I mean, it's just, you know, these films, I think Pascal definitely has a very memorable death scene, and Rossellini certainly seems to have a genius at capturing the somberness of these moments with this devastating power, this kind of unblinking stare into the ultimate of an end of life experience of a life that's been well lived, fully experienced and explored. And you know, there's something that's very heroic to me as far as this kind of filmmaking, because he's not afraid to go there, and yet he's not doing it in a way that I think is mawkish or manipulative. Yeah. There's no swelling of strings, there's no, you know, artfully placed tear on the cheek. It's just pretty straight stuff.
Yeah.
It seems like it's an easy thing. If you don't handle it with that kind of austerity, you could really easily fumble it, or it would just kind of, you know, just fizzle out. To me, these films and these culminating scenes just make a very powerful impact.
Yeah. And you know, he never dips into the overwrought sentimentality that I think so many other directors would, you know. And I do think that his roots as a neo-realist filmmaker really come into play here, and it's a fascinating progression to look at his career and see this person who made so many films that were really kind of hallmarks of neo-realism, then kind of using some of those techniques to add in Hollywood stars with Ingrid Bergman, and then to move into these lavish epics that, honestly, these are so meticulously researched. Looking at the method that he portrays the voting for, you know, all of these really, really careful details, the purification of the speaker's podium in the trial, you know, he's really capturing some very, very realistic depictions of what scholars thought life back then was like. And I think that using those techniques, using those neo-realist techniques and the almost documentary approach produces something really unique and really interesting here.
Yeah. Even like the sacrifice of the rooster, which is kind of a mid film, you know, kind of moment, which kind of has its little payoff right at the very end as well.
Yes.
It's like, yeah, you're kind of really placed in this world, and it's in some ways just kind of a side detail, but it gives you that sense of authenticity and inhabitation of how life was lived. Even if you can't relate to it, even if you think, oh, that's animal cruelty or you know, boy, what a tedious process to select a jury or to elect you know, an official, but yeah, you get the sense of the pace of life and how these weighty matters were resolved. So I feel like Rossellini had accomplished a lot of things, and I think even in our episode of The Eclipse Viewer, in which Trevor and I talked about the Rossellini history films in that Eclipse series set, we talked a little bit about Rossellini's motives. He really wanted to educate society, and he, you know, in his own kind of charmingly naive way, recognized television as a way of reaching mass audiences. Boy, I wish his vision of the mass media as a means of educating and connecting with large populations to kind of focus their thoughts and maybe elevate their conscience a bit. I wish that had been more successful. Maybe it was. Maybe there are some things that were happening in Italy and European society that I just have no clue about. But I'm not sure I see broadcast TV over the decades since as really being utilized in this way. But I am really grateful that Rossellini at least gave us this fairly slim selection of films, and what I wouldn't give to see more directors with his, even a measure of his talent, you know, creating works on this scale. I mean, I don't know. It's just one of those little unique paths left traveled in the cinematic arts, but I am glad that we have what we do.
Yeah, and I will say that rewatching this, which to me I thoroughly enjoyed, and again, it's not a film for everyone, but I found so many moments delightful. It's made me really eager to revisit those history films that I saw years ago, because I feel like there's going to be things that I didn't catch the first time around, things that I just didn't understand about his technique and what he was attempting to do. And it makes me really eager to tackle the Taking of Power of Louis Couture's, I think. It makes me really eager to tackle that one. One of the few of those that I haven't seen.
It's good. And that was really, I mean, that was kind of what started him on this whole path of these kind of very, you know, rich and again, somewhat didactic historic recreations. The other thing too, I mean, these movies are just bursting with big ideas. I mean,
you really
can hit the pause button and say, let me just think about it. In fact, one of the things in my most recent rewatch, I would find that I would like sort of grab onto an idea or a statement and just kind of let my mind wander with that. It's like, oh, I just missed it. And I'd have to hit the rewind a little bit there. So anyways, I mean, I think we've gone on a pretty good length with this film. And, if you haven't already picked up on it, dear listener, we like this stuff. So, you know, I know this is probably not going to be rushing to the top of a lot of listeners' cues, but when you're ready, or when you just say, hey, let's step out of the contemporary hurly burly hustle bustle of 21st century life, and let's take a look at how things were, you know, 2,500 years ago. So I think Socrates, on the visual elements at least, is going to give you as clear of a window into life in those times as what we're likely to find just about anywhere. So
Yeah, and I just, you know, I encourage you to let yourself be seduced by the very, very deliberate rhythms of the film. And once you do, it's a real joy to watch.
Excellent. Well, I think we'll bid Socrates a sweet and fond farewell on those notes. So thank you for listening in, everybody. We've enjoyed this time, and I hope you've gotten something out of it as well. My next episode is going to be a big one, McCabe and Mrs. Miller. You know, as I've been kind of talking a little bit these past few episodes about some of the less celebrated titles, I think McCabe and Mrs. Miller is probably a pretty big one. You know, Warren Beatty, Robert Altman, Julie Christie, some cool stuff going on there. We've got Ingmar Bergman's The Touch coming up soon, getting into the Pasolini, Decameron. Some cool stuff coming up in the episodes ahead. So I definitely welcome you to listen in and hang in there with us as we continue our exploration of the great Criterion films of 1971. All right, any last words, Josh, before we let you go?
I think that's it. Thanks for having me. This was fun.
Excellent. Well, thanks for joining me, and we'll talk to you all soon. Bye-bye.
Bye.